On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Yes, LA is going to be able to ram it again. After 2 decades without a pro football team, the Rams are coming back, and we might even get a bonus team in the deal. The Rams left LA back in 1995, and yesterday NFL owners voted to let them come back into a new $2 billion stadium being built in Inglewood. And they give the Chargers a year to decide if they want in on that deal, too. Here to talk more about this is our dynamic sports duo, Randy and Jason Sklar.
Hello.
Hi, you guys.
Please tell me that song did not come from the valley.
Yeah.
I don't want the other side or the other...
It has different Ram. It has different ramifications.
Yeah. Ooh. Wow, you guys. You guys are quick on the draw.
I'm
Oh, my gosh. Okay, let's talk about it. You guys are from St. Louis. Is this a bittersweet moment for you?
A little bit of a bittersweet moment. I was actually happy that there was football in St. Louis. And, you know, not even so much that it was the Rams. Because we grew up as St. Louis Cardinals fans.
And
football,
then they moved to
football
Arizona.
Cardinals. Then they moved to Arizona. And now you've got the Rams. And, I mean, Rams are like us.
Randy and I feel like the Rams are like the Sklar brothers.
Spent about 20 years in St. Louis, moved to L.A. to make it big.
And do you have a music video like that one?
No, but I.
But
one.
The Rams, like us, will just meet with mediocre success. So,
so
enjoy that.
Enjoy that, Los Angeles.
Okay, well, speaking of, do Angelenos care? Do they really want the Rams here?
Here's the thing about the Rams is that there is a history, you know, from the late 40s until 95, the Rams were here and had some good memories and had some great players, Eric Dickerson being one of them.
Jones. I mean, there were some big time marquee NFL players here in Los Angeles.
And traditions. You can lean back on that tradition. It's not like a expansion team or a team that's never been here. And so there is precedent for them to be back here. And I think old fans who remember them from the 80s and 90s will be happy that they're back and that there is football in the second largest market in the United States. And really, this was all, and I know you're going to get into this later, but this was all about money and who was going to pay for this thing. And Stan Kroenke, the owner
of the Rams,
he said, I'm going to pay for this out of my own money, which is insane.
Tell us a little bit more about him, because he owns a slew of other teams.
He owns a lot of teams in Colorado. He owns part of Arsenal, which is a major team in the
Barclays Premier League.
Yeah,
soccer team, which has a chance to potentially win the whole Barclays Premier League this year. They're playing really well. And he's from St. Louis. He's actually from Columbia, Missouri. And so he has season tickets to the St. Louis Baseball Cardinals. And he supports all the University of Missouri sports teams. He's actually pretty entrenched in St. Louis sports. So it feels like even more of a betrayal to people in St. Louis. We've spoken to some people in St. Louis, and they feel very betrayed. Like, our friend of ours sent us an email, and he had nothing to do with anything sports or Rams, and he signed it off with an expletive to Stan Kroenke. So that's the way they're feeling in St. Louis right now, that he really betrayed them, because the city was prepared to build with city money, build a billion-dollar stadium on the riverfront in St. Louis. And he said, no, I'm going to take the money from my own pocket and do it elsewhere,
Why would he do that? He wanted to move here. Why?
I think the opportunity to be in this market and the opportunity for...
When you think about what he's trying to build, it's not just a stadium. It's a stadium. It's a practice facility. It's condominiums. It's stores. It's essentially like what LA Live did for downtown around the Staples Center. They're trying to build that in Inglewood. And what he's trying to do...
It's really closely akin to what Jerry Jones did in Dallas with that
mega stadium
that has the national championship in college football every year and Super Bowls. I mean, LA is such a great destination in terms of great weather and minus this winter. But
So maybe they'll be able to attract better players because it's LA.
First of all, you'll attract great players because people want to live in LA. It's a great place to live, and it's really a cool place to live if you are a star athlete. So,
and money. You'll have money to pay players, because when you think about what the Dodgers
contracts.
Think about the Dodgers TV contract and think about all the money they're spending and all the money they're spending on their payroll, and they're still making money because this is a giant market where you can make a lot of money on the TV
deal. The question is, tickets are going to be expensive. will the normal fan who was a fan of the Rams or just a regular guy or woman be able to afford tickets to these eight games?
Because these tickets aren't just the tickets for the game. If you want season tickets, you have to pay what is called a PSL. That's a personal seat license. You have to pay a fee
just for the right to buy a season ticket.
Really? Yes. So how much would that cost?
I mean, so we're
thousands of dollars.
Thousands
really?
Of dollars.
Yeah, so you're talking the normal fan who would probably go in for maybe $100 or $200 a ticket. This is way above what they could do. So the question is, what kind of people are going to be coming out to the games? Is it a corporate atmosphere? Is it going to be these diehard fans? Because what some of what makes football great, and we had the opportunity to go to Cincinnati this past season and be on the field as a game was going on, and you really got the feeling that true Cincinnati people, tickets have been passed down from generation to generation, and real people were there, and it was so exciting. You wonder if that's going to be here when all is said and done and the, you know, $2 billion stadium
yeah.
is
well,
built.
Well, what if the Chargers come too? Would that change?
Well,
the
Chargers come too. The question is, are they going to help pay for the stadium or are they going to be tenants in the stadium? They're going to probably
now,
share
the stadium.
The Chargers
quarterback, Philip Rivers, has eight children. Eight.
So they may not want to come when he finds out how expensive to send their kids to
school,
private school.
We had two kids, and I'm prepared to tell one of them you're not going to high school.
I'm guessing he makes a little bit more than you.
I think so.
We're joking. But the point is that they may actually rent the stadium from – the question is, will they be part owners in the mm-hmm. stadium if they come, or will they be tenants in the stadium?
And then how is L.A. going to support two teams when we've had no – I mean, we haven't had a professional football team in L.A. since Pete Carroll was the coach at USC.
And he's joking because they should not be a professional team. It's a college team, although there is a question as to whether or not the Rams players will make as much money.
The question there in that we now support USC and UCLA when it comes to football.
True.
We do, but the NFL...
Will we also support an NFL team?
Here's the thing. The NFL is more popular now than it's ever been. It is the most popular sport. Of all the sports that are happening right now, the NFL is the most popular sport. So, you know, you can't even compare it to 94 till today. I think just having a franchise in a city is a big deal. And so I think they will be supported. The question is, will the Raiders come here too? All three teams could come here. They might all three play in Inglewood. They'd build a stadium in Carson for the Raiders, but there's a chance that can happen. The NFL has wanted football in Los Angeles for so long, for so many reasons. Again, you could have Super Bowls here and playoffs and national championship and college football and even basketball if you wanted to. There's so many things you could do here in LA that they've wanted it. They've wanted a presence here and they haven't had one that they're willing to do whatever they can.
Is there any chance that they could revive the Carson deal and bring the Raiders down for Carson?
Sure, it won't happen this year. And by the way, the stadium won't be built until 2019.
The Rams are coming, but they're not going to be in this amazing $2 billion
stadium. Right, they'll play at the Coliseum.
They'll play at the Coliseum, which is where they used to play, where USC plays. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I mean, it's not going to be pretty. It's not going to be pretty until 2019 or whenever this stadium is going to be built. You know, it may actually make the area better around there. It's like there are unintended positive effects as well.
Look, you could be trying to get to LAX, you know, and you're a couple hours early for your flight.
Go take in a Rams game. It's like the new cell phone lot. You know, someone's coming in, their flight's delayed. I'll watch a couple quarters. It's right there by LAX.
Yeah, why not?
Why not?
Well, okay, but that also brings in the whole issue of the 405 and traffic.
Traffic. Yikes. You want to talk about traffic, it's going to be.
Sunday used to be our like respite day a little bit.
Sunday I would just drive around on some of the freeways just because I'm like, yeah, this city's well planned out.
What freedom tastes like.
It's just on regular days I'll drive up and down the 2 just for the heck of it. Because I'm like, no one's on here. This is what a highway's supposed to be like.
So wait, were you going back? Were you surprised that the Chargers and the Raiders lost out on this?
No, because of the deal that was presented. And, you know, remember that we were talking about Iger coming in and kind of helping out the Carson deal.
I mean, it's all about money. And when Kroenke's like, I'll put up my money and I'll make the stadium here. And they had the best deal and the most sort of claim.
The presentations of the Raiders and the Chargers. I mean, it was described by one owner that Kroenke's deal was Star Wars, like watching Star Wars, okay? And the other two deals were like watching bad 1970s home movies. That was the comparison.
Or like a certain Ramit video.
Ramit. I was going to say like the current Star Wars versus Phantom Menace. Now that's getting deep. Now I know we're getting deep.
So meta.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, okay. But initially there was the advisory committee of the owners voted for the Carson deal.
I know, but I really think, again, money rules the day. And if one person is going to do it and put that money out there and the NFL doesn't have to put any money out to help
neither
out.
Neither does the city.
The city doesn't have to. You know, you get the feeling. And some people are saying, God, L.A. did it right. Nobody has to pay a dime and the stadium gets built. They just waited for the right time for someone with a lot of money to take a team and bring it back.
Are you going to be fans?
You know, it's hard to say. We're trying to suss out our fandom. Were we fans of the Rams because they were in St. Louis, or did we grow to like the Rams over the last 15, 20 years in St. Louis? And we will find out. I think it remains to be seen. We're still a little hurt. Yeah. As St. Louisans.
Really?
I mean, yes, we live in L.A.
But think about, like, Oakland. You already said that you want to leave. Now you got to go back up. It's like going to back to your wife.
Breaking
and
up with your wife and saying, I'm coming back and staying.
In the bed. No, not going to happen. I think they're going to have to play a few games on Alcatraz or something like that. You know,
just to punish them.
Randy and Jason Sklar, the Sklar brothers. You can see them and do it at the Trend Zone on NFL.com. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Big Bad Jackie and I'm starting this off. The Rams get down so nobody score. And don't you worry, cause the Rams are rapping. When game time comes, we'll be back to zapping. We can't sing and our dance is not pretty, but we'll do our best for the team and the city. So get on your feet and clap your hands. Let's ram it right now with the LA Rams.
Okay, let's talk now about where the Rams will play in Inglewood. Stan Kroenke plans to build a stadium that could cost more than $2 billion, and it wouldn't be ready for at least 3 more years. Joining me to discuss whether or not this is a good deal for Inglewood and for all of Southern California is Courtney Brunius, Associate Director of the USC Marshall Sports Business Institute. Hi there.
How's it going, Madeline?
Great. Okay, so Stan Kroenke is paying for this entire thing?
He is. He is paying for the construction of the stadium. He also has some money that he's putting into the development around the stadium as well. So it's a little bit unique in terms of a private financing of the deal. Obviously, there's a little bit of a negotiation and contract there with the city of Inglewood that has some, some money around the edges. But for all intents and purposes, Kroenke is building the stadium himself.
So he has an extra $2 billion he can spend on this.
He has many billions of dollars. He probably does not need to play the Powerball. That's how wealthy he is. So, he has the ability to do this on his own.
Right. Okay. But what about some hidden costs for taxpayers?
There are a few hidden costs. I mean, when you look at some of the game day operations and sort of what cities do when it comes to supporting events or supporting developments, off-site costs, security, shuttles, various sort of public devices that they are responsible for on a daily, monthly, and annual basis. Those are the type of things that the city of Inglewood will ultimately probably end up be responsible for. There's some language in the deal between the city and the Rams that sort of spells that out, who's responsible for what and how much goes back to the Rams once a certain threshold is met, but it's around the edges, and it could be a few million dollars a year. I've seen estimates at $8 million a year for some of the public costs that will be associated with. But overall, when you talk about a $2 billion project, this is a project that's the majority of it is privately financed.
Yeah. So I guess they're hoping that, the city's hoping at least, that it'll get that back and more when it comes to tax receipts from restaurants and other assorted revenue.
Exactly. Restaurants that get built around the venue, tax revenue coming in from having the team there, more people coming into Inglewood based on the football games every week, and just that overall, what we call a sort of sports-anchored real estate development of a stadium and a lot of mixed use going around that stadium will generate a lot of money for the city and hopefully a revitalization of the area.
Right. So what is this going to look like, this entire development?
It's going to be a huge development. It's one of those things where you look and think of a stadium coming in, and a lot of stadiums that get built are only their solitary structures. You have the stadium, you have a parking structure around there, and very few amenities around that. This is not that type of deal. We're talking about a stadium. We're talking about restaurants and residential and probably commercial establishments and an entire complex that becomes a destination for people that visit Los Angeles or just go to a game. They don't just go to a game, but they probably spend more time in the surrounding area, which generates additional revenue for all those involved.
In the last segment, the Sklar brothers were talking about what St. Louis was trying to offer to keep the Rams in St. Louis, and we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars in city money that was being offered to them, and they said no. So how rare is it for a stadium to be built entirely with private money?
It's pretty rare, and it's also pretty rare to see a situation where the hometown team has sort of stepped up to offer public dollars toward a venue and still see their team leave. But this is a situation where the ownership of the Rams was intent on moving to Los Angeles. They had the money and the backing to be able to build what their vision was for a new stadium that had all the amenities that you'd connect with a brand new spanking stadium in Los Angeles. So, you know, it's a unique situation in that regards, not only in terms of the private financing here, but also what the public was willing to do back in St. Louis.
And have they done an environmental impact report in terms of how this will affect, let's say, traffic and everything else?
There have been some traffic reports done. I'm sure there will be more done in terms of what it looks like once the stadium is opened in 2019 or beyond, depending on how long the construction schedule looks like. But you can't really get away from traffic when you talked about Los Angeles and any type of sports venue, especially one that it will be accessed from the 405 and some of the other freeways that are a little tough to get around on, depending on the time of day. So, you know, it's one of those things where the venue, unfortunately, isn't going to be that close to public transportation. I think the closest public trans is about a mile away. There's been talk about having shuttles going back and forth from those sort of public transportation hubs to get people to and from them on game day, but you're not really going to get around the issue of traffic in L.A., mm-hmm. especially in a situation like this.
And then the football season is pretty short, relatively speaking, September to February about. So what's going to happen there the rest of the year?
Well, it's an opportunity to have a number of events beyond just NFL games. I'm sure the venue will be in the running for the college football playoff events. There will be concerts there. Any type of major event that you think that you can hold you need a large venue to hold, this new stadium will be in the running for. So it's not only a play about just the NFL games. It's about all the entertainment aspects that come along with that and the big event sort of process for concerts, for sports, for any other type of deal that you can think of that would hold themselves in a structure like that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That's Courtney Brunias, Associate Director of USC's Marshall Sports Business Institute. Well, we want to hear from you now. Are you excited about the Rams coming back to Los Angeles or not? Are you already looking up to sign up for season tickets? Let us know at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or Twitter, Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the program, did you know there was a Spanish language response to the president's State of the Union last night? It was supposed to be just basically a Spanish translation of Nikki Haley's GOP response, but it differed in a major way on one particular issue. We'll talk about that next on Press Play.
Immerse yourself in Rhythm Planet, hosted by Tom Schnabel, the world music blog and podcast dedicated to history, storytelling, and, of course, the music. Check it out now at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Sputnik, it seems, was the star of President Obama's State of the Union address last night.
60 years ago, when the Russians beat us into space, we didn't deny Sputnik was up there. We didn't argue about the science or shrink our research and development budget. We built a space program almost overnight, and 12 years later, we were walking on the moon.
President Obama there talking about America's great promise. The speech was mostly positive, much more hope than change. And the GOP's response was also a kinder, gentler version of what's playing out on the campaign trail now. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley shared her personal story of being the child of immigrants.
For me, that starts right where it always has. I am the proud daughter of Indian immigrants who reminded my brothers, my sister, and me every day how blessed we were to live in this country.
And here is Florida Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart offering a Spanish version of the Republican response.
Para mí, eso comienza desde el principio. Soy el hijo de cubanos exiliados, quienes nos recordaban a mis hermanos y a mí todos los días la bendición que significa vivir en este gran país.
For our Spanish-speaking listeners, this will sound very familiar. It's almost the same exact personal bio, down to the wording, as Governor Nikki Haley's. In fact, the speeches were basically the same, with one major difference. When it came to immigration issues, the two speeches offered two different GOP versions for the future of reform. Joining us now is Patricia Mazzei, political writer with the Miami Herald. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. Well, first question, is this normal for there to be a Spanish version of the GOP response?
It is normal, and actually, the last 3 years, it has been given by Cuban-American Republican members of Congress from Miami. And sometimes the speeches align almost identically, and other times, they're different.
Who writes the speeches, and who approves them?
Well, they are written in concert with the House Speaker's office that, you know, settles on some messages and themes that they want to touch on after the president's speech. And the leader of the writing is usually the English respondent. And then the Spanish person gets to do their kind of revisions and edits as needed. And it all goes through the speaker's office.
So the speaker has the final word. Paul Ryan has the speaker as the speaker has the final word.
Well, I don't think that, you know, he gets to line item veto the speech necessarily, uh-huh. but it's all done in concert with them in terms of this is a message we want to give. We're not going to give a line by line response to the president. We are going to settle on certain themes we want to hit.
All right. So what did Nikki Haley have to say about immigration issues in her speech?
Well, she had four paragraphs about immigration where she said that, you know, they had to fix the immigration system. But her line was, I will read it to you now. It means stopping illegal immigration and welcoming properly vetted legal immigrants, regardless of their race or religion. She said we couldn't have flat out open borders. We could not continue to have immigrants come into the country illegally. And in the age of terrorism, they could not let in refugees whose intentions cannot be determined. So this sounds like standard kind of Republican Party fare for, you know, the immigration system needs to work better. Díaz Balart, who is a leading proponent of immigration reform in the House, just took a much softer tone.
And so what did he say?
He did not use words like illegal or terrorism. He did not refer to open borders. He said that the immigration system needs to be reformed because it puts the national security at risk and is an obstacle for the economy. And then the key part is we need to find a legislative solution to protect our nation, defend our borders, offer a permanent and humane solution to those who live in the shadows, respect the rule of law, modernize the visa system, and push the economy forward.
So it sounds like he was speaking mainly about Latin American immigration, and Nikki Haley was talking mainly about the Syrian refugee issue.
He, you're right, does not touch on refugees at all, actually. But he also just doesn't use the kind of language that immigration activists are just turned off by. You know, there is always the question about whether you should call people illegal immigrants. Can a person be illegal? Should you call them undocumented? He just doesn't go there at all. He takes a more conciliatory tone.
And so is this the Republican Party speaking out of, you know, both sides of its mouth at the same time in different
languages?
Well,
they were charged with doing that last year because the Republican response in 2015 in English, actually did not mention immigration at all, whereas the Spanish one did. So that was an even more glaring example of saying different things to different audiences. In this case, it was much more subtle because in both languages, both speakers touched on the issue for about the same length of time. But it's a matter of knowing your audience and also perhaps trying to play to them a little bit. And if you are bilingual like I am and you heard both, you maybe felt like, well, which one is it? Are we going to focus more on terrorism and on closing the border, or are we going to focus more on a legislative solution that brings both sides together?
And so what do Latino voters make of all this?
I think it's not unusual for them to hear kind of different messages in different languages. You know, it would be a bigger problem if this were the same speaker giving different lines, one day in one language and one day in another. The only one who was kind of able to avoid that when he gave the Republican State of the Union response was Marco Rubio, who's now running for president, because he delivered his own speech in English and in Spanish. And he was careful not to give a different message. But, you know, it does not sit well with the activists that I've spoken to who, in general, favor comprehensive immigration reform, to be told one harsher message in English than in Spanish.
So looking at the bigger picture here and looking at the campaign and going into the presidential election season in full force, what with Iowa just around the corner, the Republican Party is trying to court Latino voters. How successful is it, given some of the harsh rhetoric that we're hearing?
I think it's better than it was last year in that they brought up the topic and didn't ignore it in English entirely. But it is such a big challenge for the party not to alienate Hispanic voters who might be really interested in hearing what Republicans have to say, but are just turned off when they start hearing about immigration. It's almost like a putting on blinders, like, well, we can't see past this. So obviously the party is aware of this, and the Speaker's office is aware of this. You don't appoint someone like Mario Díaz-Balart, the congressman, to give this speech without knowing that he's going to take this kind of tone on immigration, because that's his big issue. So it's a matter of finding the middle ground, and you could tell in general by both Republican responses yesterday that they're wrestling with issues within their own party, not just with Latinos, right, but with Donald Trump and with the base of the party. And this is just going to keep playing out, I think, in the primaries as we move forward.
Patricia Mazzei, politics writer for the Miami Herald. Thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up on the show, what the president said and didn't say about Syria last night and what it means for his presidency.
The Syria conundrum will probably be the biggest legacy because it has the most staying power and the most horrific examples of how the world is not necessarily becoming a better place.
We'll continue our series, Unfinished Business, time to the president's final State of the Union address after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We're going to take a closer look now at what the president said last night in his State of the Union address about Syria. All this week on the show, we're discussing the president's unfinished business as he begins his last year in office. And Syria is certainly that. The war has dragged on there for nearly 5 years and shows no signs of ending soon. Well, last night, the president talked about Syria as the front line on terror.
For more than a year, America has led a coalition of more than 60 countries to cut off ISIL's financing, disrupt their plots, stop the flow of terrorist fighters, and stamp out their vicious ideology. With nearly 10,000 airstrikes, we're taking out their leadership, their oil, their training camps, their weapons. We're training, arming, and supporting forces who are steadily reclaiming territory in Iraq and Syria.
Well, Andrew Tabler joins us now. He's a fellow at the Washington Institute, a foreign policy think tank, where he focuses on Syria. Welcome to the program.
My pleasure being here with you.
Well, that clip that we just played really had more to do with ISIS than Syria, but you can't disentangle the two. What did you think about what the president said last night?
Well, it wasn't unusual that the president gave an ISIS-centric approach, right, to the problems that are coming from the Middle East. This is the one that, you know, generally grabs headlines. But of course, ISIS did not come out of nowhere. In fact, it came out of a vacuum in what is Syria or whatever it used to be or whatever it is now. And it's there where the administration's policy has come under extreme criticism because of laying down markers that the U.S., in terms of a policy in Syria, where it was unable to achieve under Obama and will not be able to achieve while he is president.
So he didn't really mention regime change, which he has mentioned in the past, several years ago, I guess, at this point. But he didn't really talk about Bashar al-Assad.
No, he didn't. And I think that's that indicates exactly, you know, how he sees it. I think the government, and the Obama administration in particular, wants Assad to go as part of a political solution. And I don't think that will ever change, no matter who's president, very much like Saddam Hussein in the 90s. On the other hand, they do not want him to go catastrophically because they were afraid it would be a boon for ISIS and other jihadist groups. The problem, of course, is that the party now propping up Bashar al-Assad is not an American ally. It's an American adversary, Russia, and they are carrying out strikes in Syria willy-nilly against many groups that are backed by not only our allies in the region, but also the United States itself.
Right, and there's also the Iran factor, which complicates things enormously.
Exactly. So the Iranians are big backers of Bashar al-Assad and backers of the Kurds also inside of Syria. The Assad regime's approach to this has historically been to try and blast their way out of the country's largest uprising. And currently, Bashar al-Assad controls about 25% of Syrian territory. That hasn't worked terribly well. They're hoping with some support from the Russians and some political support from the international community that Assad would be able to pull that off. Of course, it begs the question, you know, how do you come back from holding such little territory, even if you're in the capital and you're Bashar al-Assad and you're looking out at the entire country?
Mm-hmm. So the president talked last night about quagmires. He talked about Vietnam, Iraq. And he said we should have learned lessons from them, but we haven't.
We also can't try to take over and rebuild every country that falls into crisis, even if it's done with the best of intentions. That's not leadership. That's a recipe for quagmire, spilling American blood and treasure that ultimately will weaken us. It's the lesson of Vietnam. It's the lesson of Iraq, and we should have learned it by now.
Is he trying to equate Syria with that? In other words, is he trying to say, look, we shouldn't get involved in a long, drawn-out war there, boots on the ground, that kind of thing, because it'll just end up being another Iraq? And if so, how does he make the distinction between what could happen and what is already happening there?
Yeah, so I think the president talked about these quagmires, about his desire to avoid them. And I think that's wise. But of course, just avoiding a quagmire militarily doesn't mean you are not affected by it in other ways. And I think that's where the United States, has a lot of leftover issues, or rather President Obama will leave these issues for an incoming president. He talked about a patient and disciplined policy in Syria, and a sort of way to intervene that was not what his predecessor George Bush carried out in Iraq. Of course, I don't know anyone that believes that patient and disciplined policy in Syria is working. Instead, we have a situation where, despite the fact that we did not intervene, we have large swaths of the Syrian opposition and the Sunni community in the Middle East in general very angry at us because of our lack of action in Syria to support our values, supporting human rights and safety for civilians and so on. The other aspect of this that is extremely controversial is the recent nuclear deal with Iran, which on the one hand deals with their nuclear program, but on the other is used as the foundation for what the president has called rebalancing in the region. And rebalancing is sort of code for allowing the Iranians back into the region in that pre-1979 way to check the interests of the Saudis, the Turks, and ultimately the Israelis. And that's extremely controversial and drives a lot of the conflict that we see in Syria and Yemen and elsewhere.
Oh, that's interesting. And how does yesterday's brief detention of the American sailors, does that play into that at all?
It does, because I think the problem that we have is that while we have a nuclear deal with Iran and it deals with some aspects of its nuclear program, there are knock-on effects and benefits for the Islamic Republic that are not in U.S. interests. And if they end up, if the Iranians are allowed to support Assad or support the Iraqi government or support the Houthis in Yemen, that is going to really run up against the core Sunni Arab interests throughout the Middle East. And under the current environment, and as we saw with the recent dust-up between Saudi Arabia and Iran, I don't think these parties are going to stop fighting each other anytime soon. It would have been more advantageous if the nuclear agreement was implemented in a more peaceful time. But unfortunately, countries like Iran and Saudi Arabia, Shia and Sunni, are at each other's throats more than ever before. And that puts a lot of question marks over what President Obama's legacy in the Middle East is going to be.
What do you think his legacy is going to be?
Well, the nuclear agreement itself, I think, it will be held up as the primary foreign policy victory for the Obama administration, an accomplishment. And in many ways, it is remarkable that the agreement was able to be reached, and it went through a long, circuitous route before all the different parties were able to sit down at the table. But I think the Syria conundrum will probably be the biggest legacy because it has the most staying power and the most horrific examples of how the world is not necessarily becoming a better place. And I think it will be probably the most controversial legacy of the Obama administration because of the associated terrorist threats that come out of Syria. Most notably that of ISIS. Mm-hmm. If there are either small-scale, medium-scale, or large-scale, God forbid, terrorist attacks that are associated with ISIS here in an election year, we could see something closer to 1979 in the United States, where a foreign policy issue comes out of nowhere and ends up affecting the general election in 2016.
Well, of course, he would argue, and lots of people would argue, that it isn't really President Obama's legacy, the Syria conundrum. It's really President Bush's legacy because of the war in Iraq.
Well, yes, there are some that say that because the United States invaded Iraq and knocked out Saddam Hussein, that therefore that started all of this. But the reasons for the Syrian uprising have more to do with governance in that country and the minority basis, Alawite basis of the regime there. And the primary dynamic throughout the Arab world was not determined by the United States. And the primary dynamic is this. In these countries where we've seen uprisings, we have rigid, extremely rigid political systems which cannot reform. And on the other hand, we have population growth rates which are comparable with sub-Saharan Africa. And so these two things have been on a collision course for a long time. And so what America now needs to do in many ways, whether it wants to deal with the terrorist threat or the humanitarian suffering or the migrant threat, is it needs to anticipate these problems and see what the United States and its allies can do to positively affect these outcomes. But the president's approach has been a hands-off one. And I don't think, looking at the Middle East as it is now, as he's about ready to hand off power to a new president, that the situation's getting better. And if a lot of Americans agree with that assessment, I think we could see a very heated debate during the 2016 election over what to do next. What can the United States do? We've tried intervention in the invasion of a country under President Bush. We've tried a hands-off approach under President Obama. Is there a happy medium that can help secure America's future? And that's the real question, I think, that for the upcoming election.
Andrew Tabler, fellow at the Washington Institute. That's a foreign policy think tank. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Right, and that's part of our Unfinished Business series. We're taking a look at the president's unfinished business in his last year in office. Hi, Warren Olney.
Hi. There will always be unfinished business,
there
and that's what campaigns
will.
Are always about.
Well, speaking of finished business, your show at 1 o'clock.
We will be talking about the president's State of the Union address and also about the Republican response from Nikki Haley, the person who was elected governor of South Carolina on a sort of Tea Party ticket, who last night sort of tore into Donald Trump, not directly, but indirectly. It was very interesting. And in context of what the president was saying and the way the campaign is going, it makes for a very interesting conversation about other kinds of unfinished business.
Okay. Thank you very much. That's at 1 o'clock, To the Point with Warren Olney. And coming up on this program, it is not too late, Warren Olney, to get in on the action. The Powerball drawing is tonight. We'll have the answers to a lot of your questions about it, such as what happens to all that money the winner doesn't get? It's all coming up next on Press Play.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Check your tickets. We have the winning Powerball numbers. No, we don't. Sorry. The drawing is tonight at 8 o'clock, but I bet a lot of you are super excited. And that probably includes a good number of you who have never played the lottery before. So good luck. Your odds of winning are 1 in 292 million. Even if you have not bought a ticket, you have to have heard that the Powerball jackpot is up to a whopping record-breaking $1.5 billion. It could go even higher by tonight. But what else do we know about the Powerball? Scott McFetridge has all the answers. He's Iowa, Nebraska news editor for the Associated Press. Welcome.
Hello.
So, first of all, why are we talking to you? What is it about Iowa that is central to the lottery?
I am lucky enough to write a lot about Powerball because the organization is based here. It's actually kind of run more by state lotteries all around the country, but kind of the back office kind of thing is here in suburban Des Moines.
And so this is the Multi-State Lottery Association. How do they run this lottery? How did it all start?
So there were Powerball states, and then there were Mega Million lottery states. About 5 years ago, 44 states agreed to sell each other's games. The Multi-Lottery Association are the ones who started Powerball, and so that's the organization that oversees things, although, again, it's really all done more by the state lotteries themselves in each of the states.
So I guess the chairmanship, if you will, of the multi-state lottery, it goes from state to state?
It does. It moves every year. This year it's in Texas, and that's why people might notice a lot of the comments about the Powerball come from the Texas Lottery Executive Director. Mm-hmm. It'll move to another state next year.
So then do the payouts differ depending on which state you live in?
It's one payout. It is one payout, although there can be a big difference or some difference based on different tax policies from state to state. But the $1.5 billion jackpot, that is the same throughout all the 44 states.
All right, so let's talk about this particular Powerball. This is the biggest jackpot in the history of lotteries in the world. It's gigantic. And yet, it's not a total surprise that it's so big because the Powerball officials have tinkered with the formula and made it so that there would be bigger payouts.
Right. Every few years, they have tinkered with it so that they would grow this much larger jackpot. First, they increased the odds to 1 in 175 million, and then last fall, they increased it to the 1 in 292.2 million. And they knew, just mathematically, they knew that would mean that occasionally the jackpot would grow a lot larger. Although even then, they didn't really know how large it was going to be, and they say that they didn't realize it was going to grow this fast. Because, you know, the reason it's grown this large is no one has won it since early November. So if someone had just happened to match the right numbers in early December, then we wouldn't be talking about a jackpot anywhere close to this size.
Okay, so the jackpot is growing, but the odds do not change.
Right, the odds are the same. And I think that is a misconception people have, is that they think that somehow it can change based on the number of people playing, but your odds for a single ticket remain the same, whatever happens.
So why do they make this decision to make the odds greater?
Well, because they knew that what was happening right now would happen, which is if they grew the jackpot larger, more people would play, more people would pay attention to it. They say that there is this phenomena where once a jackpot grows to a certain size, there never will be the same amount of interest if the next jackpot grows to that same size. So you're kind of in this constant need to increase the prize. And but, they knew that if they could get it that big, we'd all be talking about it.
Right, which we are, of course, and everybody is. But, I mean, is there a point where people are just going to say, oh, this is ridiculous. I don't have any chance. I'm not going to buy a ticket.
I've wondered about that. I mean, we haven't got there yet. But I have wondered about, you know, let's say there is a winner tonight and it's and so someone gets the $1.5 billion. So what happens next time? I mean, do we, you know, if we have in 6 months, if we have a billion-dollar jackpot, do we all just yawn and don't pay attention? Or do you need to get, you know, $1.7 million or $2 billion? I don't know. And the lottery people say they don't really know, that they've never been at this kind of level before, so they're not sure.
So there's the payout, it's $1.5 billion, but the lottery actually makes more money than that. And where does all that money go?
For the excess revenue that they don't pay out in prizes, different states divvy it up differently. Some states have it dedicated toward education, some have it dedicated to road work, some, like here in Iowa, I think it just goes into the general fund for the state. And it also certainly pays to operate the lottery. The retailers get a percentage of every sale, just like anything else they sell on their convenience store. So the money gets divvied up in a variety of ways.
And does the money actually go to where people say it's going to go? I mean, does it make a difference in terms of the state of the roads in Iowa, for example, or the state of the schools here in California?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is some disagreement about that. I mean, I think some states have it like go directly to scholarships for students, and that seems pretty simple. I'm sure there are some who believe that, you know, you can say that the money goes to roads, but then legislators can work around money, you know, so that instead of spending more on roads, they'll put some of the money into something else. You know, every state does it just a little bit differently. So I'm sure there are people who believe that it's not as simple as the lotteries say.
Yeah. Well, some people say, look, it's a shell game, that the lottery money would go to education, but then they would take that money from education and put it somewhere else. So it's not an overall increase in funds, just moving it around.
Right. And my guess is you have to kind of look at every state, because even certain states that have it go to education, I think they probably have different requirements. And so, you know, whereas in one state it may be easy to shift the money around, and in other states it might be more difficult. I mean, again, here in Iowa, it just goes into the general fund that the legislators can spend on everything.
So if you win, can you be anonymous?
That's a point of contention. I think there are five or six states where you can be anonymous. That worries some people, because one of the main ways to fight any possibility of fraud or cheating the system is that in most states you have to show up with your ticket that you bought and give your name. And if you have somehow scammed the system, which apparently no one has ever done to Powerball, but if you are a scammer, you're much less likely want to show up and say, it's me, here I am, here's my ticket, and to somehow explain how you got it. So in a few states, though, it is legal to be anonymous, and there's pretty good reason, because if you suddenly get $1.5 billion or even the $800-some million cash prize, you may not really want everyone in your community to know that you're suddenly, you know, the richest guy in town.
Yeah, because then you'll be the subject of probably lots of scams or would-be scams. It's really amazing that in this age of computer hacking and sophisticated scams, that the lottery, as we don't know, but if that it hasn't been hacked.
Well, there have been cases where some other games have had problems. We had a case out of Iowa just recently where someone was convicted of that. But those games are different than the Powerball, which uses that kind of old style, you know, real actual balls that get selected in a machine on live TV. But it seems, so far, it seems to be foolproof.
Did you buy a ticket?
My wife bought a ticket, one single ticket, yes.
What would you do if you won?
I really have no idea. And maybe that's how I know that I'm not going to win, is I haven't even spent any time thinking about what I would do with it. It's funny when I'll see sometimes people talk about what they would do, and it's so clear that they don't really even have a perspective of how much money this is. I mean, I talked to someone who talked about how the person who wins this will be in the top 100 income earners for the country for that year.
Well, that is putting it into perspective. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Scott McFetridge, Iowa, Nebraska news editor for the Associated Press. It appears we cannot resist that music video. That is the third time we've played it this show.
It's actually the new feedback music.
Oh, is that's your new theme?
Is everybody ready for some real optimistic 80s rap on the show?
Yes.
Here it is. And the Rams apparently are coming, so it'll give us many more opportunities to play this on the show. I plan on doing it
once
a week or so.
There you go.
Now my song sounds totally lame compared to Ram It.
Well, something to aspire to.
Yeah.
Really.
We want your covers of Ram It, by the way. Like a metal cover of it would be really nice. Maybe like
you wouldn't even need to change the
electro
hairstyles.
Pop. Yeah. It'd be good.
What are people saying about the Rams?
So our listeners are cautiously optimistic, I think. I mean, we've been burned before by the Rams, and not me personally, because I'm a Lions fan, which talk about getting burned. but our listeners were sort of divided. Mostly they came together over the fact that it was funny to see all the comments from the St. Louis fans, how sad they are, and really how angry. There's some really, really baroque death threats to Stan Kroenke out there if you want to seek them out. They're pretty ridiculous and not funny at all. But our listeners were cautiously optimistic. Hector Aguilar, not so optimistic. He says, the Rams suck, the Chargers suck, the Raiders were the only team worth a darn, and they're not coming here, so I don't know why everybody is getting so excited. David Anderson Law on Facebook says just no, to which Reggie Carson says yes, and post a picture of the Rams in LA back in the day around the time of our wonderful new feedback theme song, Ram It.
Okay, thank you. Hopefully we'll be hearing that song again and again. Jolie Myers, thank you very much. And Warren Olney, To the Point, up next. And have a great afternoon. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.